You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Don Prothro returns in this episode along with his collaborator Timothy Callahan to discuss their new book, UFOs, Chemtrails, and Aliens. A very skeptical overview of the field of ufology. As I mentioned in the interview, UFOs is a topic some people get very passionate about, some to the point of religious fervor, and I don't mean that figuratively. But if you're looking for a skeptical overview of a field that's often not given a very thoughtful rebuttal from science, I think this book may be what you need. A link to it will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org. I'd like to take longer for this preamble, but I'm behind on several projects and must send this out as it is. A note about the audio quality. We had a lot of challenges getting Don and Tim together for this interview and ended up having to do the interview on landline. Unfortunately, Tim had a bit of a cough, and I hope he's feeling better now, but I wasn't able to remove that cough from the audio because of the way everyone was connected. So, my apologies, but I hope it won't detract too much from what I think is a fun and informative conversation. Let's get to some
Monster Talk.
Today we're welcoming Donald Prothro and Timothy Callahan. Don is a geologist and paleontologist. He's the author of numerous books and scientific papers, including Reality Check, How Science Deniers Threaten Our Future, and Abominable Science, Origins of Yeti, Nessie, and Other Famous Cryptids. Don's been on the show several times. And we're welcoming, for the first time, Timothy Callahan, who is a trained artist and has worked for more than 20 years in the animation industry. And throughout his life, he's also had an active interest in science and the study of mythology and religious beliefs. And he is the religion editor for Skeptic Magazine. And together, they've collaborated on a new book called UFOs, Chemtrails, and Aliens, What Science Says. Welcome to Monster Talk.
Oh, thank you. Enjoy it.
Hi, guys. So this is a book that's about a lot of fringe topics. But what's the underlying theme that unites them all within your book?
I could say it's probably just that we're trying to approach this topic as in a very strict scientific manner and using the methods of science in a rigorous way. Too often, if you look at books that talk about UFOs, they'll sometimes talk about rules of reason and rules of logic and rules of scientific evidence, but they're not really explicit about it. And so one of the things we laid out at the beginning of the book is how scientific method works and what's testable science and what's speculation. and how what quality of evidence is required to establish something in the scientific community, which is something really necessary because so much of what constitutes evidence for UFOs and aliens does not pass muster of scientific evidence.
So I know that a lot of these themes come up on Monster Talk quite a bit, especially with eyewitness accounts and when things sort of get into the zeitgeist, they become spotted. Like the go-to example we always talk about is how Bigfoot really didn't exist as a phenomenon, but once it became part of the culture, every mysterious animal in the woods was probably a Bigfoot. Is that true in your findings in the UFO world?
Yeah, copycat phenomenon going on. It's basically the reality is that when you look at the history of these reports, they pretty much only date back to the late part of the 19th century, about the time science fiction arose, of course, and they go back of really to Jules Verne in some ways. And before that, if somebody saw something strange in the sky, they would call it an angel or a demon or some other kind of thing, but they wouldn't call it a UFO or an alien. And so really, UFOs and aliens are just a recent phenomenon, less than a little over a century old. And they really reflect a culture that really has sort of given up looking for demons in the sky. Instead, we look for UFOs. And then there's a long history, which Tim will probably talk about, of how there's a tremendous amount of copycatting. Once science fiction or science fiction magazines or television or movies introduces a particular alien meme or a particular type of spaceship, it is copycatted and then spread through the media to all through the culture, and then everybody in that generation pretty much expects to see aliens that look like that. So, for example, H.G. Wells' original aliens in the War of the Worlds look more like octopuses or spiders. And that one may be the earliest meme we know of from science fiction. But, of course, the little gray aliens we now associate with all the Steven Spielberg movies come from a much more recent generation. Tim, you could talk about this.
Yeah, the gray aliens probably have their origin in an episode of Outer Limits called The Bolero Shield. And it was only after seeing this that Barney Hill realized the aliens were these gray aliens that... Before then, his wife had nightmares, that he had nightmares that were the aliens who abducted them, had the kind of bluish lips, dark hair, and Jimmy Durante-type noses. And then the reptilians don't really appear until after the TV series V came on. And the idea of them being shape-shifting can be traced to that, too, since they were masquerading as humans. I think we can probably track the Nordic aliens back to Klaatu in the 1951 movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, where Michael Rennie is this benevolent and, you know, very human-looking alien.
Yeah, that actually happens so often in our kind of area of concern for monsters. I've started calling them scripteds because they seem to come out of movie scripts. So.
Yeah.
So what inspired you guys to collaborate on this book, though?
It was sort of a funny thing. I'd just done that book, as you know, on Bigfoot and Nessie and the rest of the cryptozoology culture with Daniel Loxton. And then, you know, I've been thinking about it for a while and realized that we could pretty much approach this same topic, the UFO topic, the same way we did with cryptozoology. And so I knew I could write on parts of it, but I really didn't feel I had the expertise in so many of it. There's gigantic literature out there and so many, many different stories and places you can read the debunking of individual stories, but not all in one place. But Tim had done this for a lot of years for Skeptic Magazine and actually written about a number of the more famous UFO hoaxes and other types of things which aren't really what they claim to be. So then I talked to Tim about it, and that's how we ended up collaborating. Then I went to Indiana, ended up liking the idea the best, and gave us a contract.
You start out the book with an introduction into the scientific method, and there's a brief look at logic, reason, critical thinking, Popper's falsifiability ideas. So is there some kind of problem with basic science literacy?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that.
Yeah, that was something I felt was necessary because you really can't assume science literacy in almost any reading American anymore. So much has been, you know, just assumed it's not really there. And especially because, you know, even people who are relatively literate in other topics may not understand science very well because it isn't explained very clearly, even in school level. And so you really have to spell out a lot of these things that are really the way real scientists operate, because most people operate with this idea of science and scientists as the stereotypes that they get from media, especially the white lab coat and the frizzy white hair and the mad scientist stereotype, right down to the sparking Van de Graaff generators and the, you know, bubbling beakers. That's a stereotype that we live with all the time, and most non-scientists often think of scientists that way.
There's also a tendency for them to say, well, here's a strange thing. You should explain it. They get it backwards around. That if we can't explain something, then it must be UFOs.
Right.
Yeah.
That's something we repeat over and over again in the book. The unexplained is not necessarily unexplainable. And the nature of science is such there will always be an unexplained area that's on the fringe of what we've so far explained. In most cases, we end up finding out what that is and explaining it. But even if we don't resort to anything paranormal as a cop-out. It's always, if it's not explained, it's just in the unexplained category. And that's basically, and it implies into topic UFO. It's unidentified flying object. It does not necessarily mean it's unidentifiable or never will be identified. It's only unidentified at the time it was first seen. And people forget that's what UFO really stands for.
That's I think a problem in all these fringy Freudian paranormal type fields, is that so much of it comes down to an argument from ignorance. We don't know, therefore it's this, which is really kind of a peculiar construct, yet it's universal in these fields of study, or seems to be.
Yes, that's very true, because we as as human beings, we like to have answers even when there are none. And if we don't have an answer or we don't have a simple explanation for something, we'll create it. It's very much human nature to do that. That's what mythology is based on, and so much else is based on as well. When you don't understand something, you don't have an answer, you create an answer. And that's the mythologizing of cryptids has been that way for a long time, and really almost in exactly the same way the mythologizing of UFOs and aliens works the same way. And as Tim and I have talked about before in other interviews, really what this amounts to is the 20th century's version of creation myth and the religion of the scientific world, which is, you know, when science takes away a lot of our other gods, then we put UFOs and aliens in their place instead.
Yeah, that seems to be consistent with just myth-making in general, and I think you actually covered that pretty specifically in there. Talked about the Roswell effect, I think. Is that right?
They call it the Roswell effect, right?
Yeah.
The Roswell incident is thoroughly debunked in every sense. It's been so for a long time. But what the reality has happened is that it's gotten so thoroughly built up by the fringe media, especially these late-night cable shows and all this UFO literature, that people have to believe that there's something there just because it's talked about so often, even though it's, in fact, the flimsiest case in the entire UFO literature. And to show you how flimsy it was, in 1947, when it supposedly occurred, it was not even listed among the events that were thought to be mysterious UFO events of that year, because it was already been debunked and it was forgotten, and then was stayed forgotten for nearly 30 years until it was resurrected in the 1970s by UFO researchers.
It's peculiar to me because that pattern of having the story, it's basically not that complicated of a story, but it keeps growing and growing and growing. So it, and I think we've talked about that a lot on here about other monster stories, but the idea that it's one of the signs that you may be dealing with myth making is that the details keep getting more and more detailed as time goes by, and more and more it just keeps expanding. And so it literally follows a folklore pattern there, and the way that it gets passed around and expanded upon. So I really like the way that you talked about that. And now you did go into quite a few cases within this book. And it's been my experience that much like with monsters, UFOs and alien stories have grown these followings of people who are super interested in the details of particular cases. Did you find it intimidating at all, knowing that if you're going to try to do a general book, you're definitely going to disappoint some people who are experts and have devoted their life to one case or another?
They're going to happen. That's going to happen. There's a kind of a fish story quality too to these narratives. By the way, I wanted to add the Rendlesham Forest incident. The initial statement of Sergeant Peniston was that he got within 30 meters of the object, and then later on he actually got up and touched it, and then after that he was getting messages from it. And then a few years down the line, he decided it wasn't a spaceship after all. It was a time-traveling craft from the future, and that it was telepathically giving him binary code, which he wrote down in books, long books. It's very strange. And people do get indignant when you attack it. You know, how dare you say this thing? And particularly with Barney and Betty Hill, and again, it's one of these things that when you investigate it, the further you investigate it, the more it unravels.
We saw this also in the Roswell story. The major witness who actually was a witness, almost everybody else that's in the UFO literature was never at the scene and did not report anything, but Major Marcel, Jesse Marcel, was a witness. And he was, by the time the UFO researchers approached him in 77, I think, was already 30 years since the incident. He'd been out of the military for a long time. He was working as a TV repairman and not making very much money. And then along come all these UFO researchers who want his story, and the more he embellishes it, the more they pay him. And so every version of his story, what happened to Area 51, has changed and gets more and more elaborate as he supposedly remembers more details that he can then supply for these people who make these books and documentaries about Area 51. So it was, or not Area 51, excuse me, Roswell. So it was a classic case of, you know, somehow the money enhances memory.
So before we dig into a couple of particular cases in the book, you also talk about patternicity and issues with observations and the fallibility of human perception. So do people overestimate their powers of observation and memory?
Yes, that's very much the case, and that's pretty much the central case, even more so than for cryptozoology. But for UFOs, virtually the entire field rests, and with a couple of exceptions, entirely on eyewitness evidence and supposedly what humans have seen or heard or experienced. And so we have to attack that very directly. And one of the things we do right at the beginning of the book, we have a little anecdote that opens the story, which is a famous hoax from 1909 by a hoaxer by the name of Wallace Tillinghast. And this is now 6 years after the Wright brothers had flown. He claimed he had an aircraft that could fly at night, could fly at higher elevations, could fly for hours, and all these other things, and he was going to be trying to enter in an air competition in order to prevent anyone from stealing his ideas. He was only going to fly at night, and therefore, you couldn't see him do it in the daytime. And so that was planted all through the media in New England at that time in the late fall of 1909. And it wasn't, it was absurd to look at it now, but it was just a couple of steps ahead of the technology the Wright brothers and Glenn Curtiss had in 1909. They had aircraft that weren't quite able to do that yet, but he claimed he did. And so for the next few nights after it appeared in the media, over 50,000 people claimed they heard and saw his aircraft flying above them at night. And they claimed they saw it fly around the Statue of Liberty. They saw it in Boston. They saw it all over the East Coast at the same time. And night after night after night, this kept happening because the media kept feeding the frenzy until right before Christmas Eve, 1909, and then it was exposed and the entire hoax collapsed. And so the object lesson there is that 50,000 people can be wrong. They can all, because of media conditioning, believe they heard and saw something we now know was not there. And so in the book, we lay out very clearly why we view eyewitness evidence as pretty much the worst possible evidence from a scientific standpoint, and that it's so easily distorted, it's so easily influenced. The studies of people like Elizabeth Loftus and other psychologists have shown that humans are terrible video recorders. We remember things wrong. We put in details that didn't happen. After the time elapses, our memories change, and we add or subtract details. And the whole idea of eyewitness testimony has shown that virtually you can't trust anything humans see, even multiple humans, because 50,000 people were wrong about the New England airship hoax. And so that pretty much derails the entire UFO community right there, that they can't believe eyewitness evidence. They don't have much left. When I did this talk in front of a bunch of UFO believers a few months ago when the book first came out, that's one of the first things I did, and the guy was stunned. He didn't have anything to say because everything he wanted to talk about was based on eyewitness testimony.
Another classic case of that is the case of the Phoenix Lights, where very normal, ordinary people swear they saw this formation of lights in a V-shaped formation, the lights on the leading wing edge of this wing, going over slowly over Phoenix, blotting out the stars. And, you know, lots of people saw it. Fortunately, some people took videos of it. But the video camera does not show that. It shows lights hovering over the horizon, coming on one at a time, forming eventually a line, and then winking off one at a time, exactly like what you would expect, which was the Air Force's explanation of it, that they had dropped military flares on parachutes. And these aren't kooks. These aren't charlatans. These are just ordinary folks. Yeah. We have a tendency to tell ourselves stories. The fact is, our perception is our brain putting together all kinds of stuff to tell a story. You know, even, you know, vision, for example.
Yeah, I mean, there's even a better example of this pattern seeking, which, of course, is that humans, of course, are conditioned to recognize faces first and foremost among almost every pattern we can see. And there's a famous hoax where one of the very first Viking missions that flew over Mars took this very low-resolution image of the Martian surface with, of course, the sunlight coming at a low angle, so it made fairly large shadows of a hill. And, you know, it sort of has two little spots and a cross line across the hill that if you stared at it a moment, it's sort of like a simple cartoon of a face. And this con man made a whole living out of claiming the Martians had carved this face into the surface so we could see it, and that this is a real evidence of life on Mars. And it kept going, and he made tons of money after all these people who agreed with him. It looked like a face until the next mission to Mars went over. And, of course, it shot the same hill from a higher resolution at a different sun angle, and it doesn't look anything like a face. And then the third time over, of course, the details are even more clear, and it's clear it was just a you know, accident of lighting and the low resolution of that image the first time it was seen, and our tendency to see faces when there are none.
They've adapted that story, and I believe current claims are that what NASA nuked the monuments of Mars, I believe. So, you know, that's I guess
we have the robots on Mars now that aren't finding anything.
Yeah. So I wish it were true. I mean, I wish there were colonies on Mars or ancient ruins on Mars, and that would just be wonderful. It doesn't look like the geology and the evidence supports that. Even microbial life would be a really great find. And I think we'll get to some of those things, I think, as we go through these topics. What we're trying to do is kind of give people an idea of what's in your book without spoiling it. So I think we're getting there. I do want to talk a little bit about Area 51, it seems like it's got a lot of different names, and I was hoping maybe you could help us clarify what should we be calling that place.
You still call it Area 51. The story behind that is that right after World War II was over, Lockheed was starting to build these big spy planes that were designed, of course, to be flown at a real high elevation above Soviet missile and radar, they thought, and the air system of their planes at the time. And so they were looking for a really isolated airstrip that they could use to build, to test these planes. They were, you know, at the time they were still testing them at Edwards Air Force Base down here in Los Angeles County, but there was too many prying eyes down here. So the Kelly Johnson, the chief engineer for Lockheed, was one of the people who took these flights, and they flew out of all this territory in southern Nevada that's adjacent to the Nevada test site, where, of course, they were testing nukes at the time, and the Ellis Air Force Base, which is where they have most of their bombing runs over that area. And they found a strip, which is called Groom Lake. It's a natural sort of airstrip that they developed over a dry lake, very much like Edwards was when it was first developed. And it was perfect for their purposes, because not only was it an airstrip in the middle of nowhere, but it also had no place where you could see it from ground level. It was surrounded by mountains on all sides, so there's no way prying eyes and outside the base could see it. The only way you could see it at the time was to fly over it, and of course they had fighter jets protecting you from flying in restricted areas. Of course, today, now, thanks to satellites, anybody can just type Area 51 into a Google search, you know, for Google Maps, and you can see it instantly. It's one of the first hits you'll get. But at the time, it was very well protected by it. No prying eyes could see it at any point. And once they got that, it had different names depending upon whether it was Air Force or CIA you're talking to. They gave it nicknames like Paradise Ranch and things like that, and that was mostly to make the various employees of Lockheed and the Air Force feel like they were less punished than they were for living in the middle of a hellish Nevada desert with nothing for miles. And so they called it Paradise Ranch to sell it to the people who had to be stuck out there. And then it basically, you know, kept on doing its purpose, which is throughout the 1950s and 60s, it was top secret. No, nobody was allowed to know about it except those who were on the innermost circle. And where they tested first the U-2 spy plane, of course, the famous one that was shot down over Russia and Gary Powers on it at the time. After that, they developed the A-12, which became the SR-71 Blackbird, which was so high, so it flew at 90,000 feet at Mach 2 or Mach 3, that no Soviet plane or Soviet missile or anybody could reach it. It just was completely untouchable, and it flew up there for a very long time, and then eventually they started using the base to test the stealth fighter, which was also developed there as well. And all those projects, of course, were top secret until they eventually were, you know, somehow leaked out one way or another. And during the time they did this, of course, there were very strange-shaped aircraft with very strange lights on them. In the case of the Blackbird, you know, those things flew over jetliners at 40,000 feet and zipped past them from way above the jetliners. So they've actually explained a lot of the UFO sightings from that time and that place were basically the spy planes, higher than any normal passenger aircraft, flying very fast and looking very strange, especially if they lighted them at a funny angle because they had weird shapes compared to any aircraft that's familiar. So a high percentage of the UFO sightings in that area were all from these spy planes that were just secret at the time. Plus, the Air Force and the CIA had an incentive to create the story about aliens being kept there because that kept people off the real story. It's a great cover, you know. They don't want to just disavow that kind of thing because it leaves them a chance to people look in the wrong direction. It's the old magician's trick of misdirection. But the whole thing was finally released. The CIA in 2013, thanks to Freedom of Information Act, released almost everything that was ever done at Area 51 now. There are really no secrets left there at this point. Maybe current aircraft that remain top secret. The base still has top security. And the thing that really clinches it is not just that the Air Force and the CIA released everything, but also that the people who worked there have all come out pretty much now that they've been released of their vows of secrecy, and they've all talked about it. A group of men called the Roadrunners are mostly Lockheed engineers and Lockheed pilots and people like that who did this work for the Air Force and the CIA, one of whom was my father, Clifford Prothero. He worked for Lockheed his entire career, starting in the 1930s. He retired in 1976 or 77, and he was the head of technical illustration by the time he finished, and so he had top secret clearance, and several times I remember when I was younger, he would disappear for a week, and we're not allowed to ask where he was going. And then when he retired, and long after he was released, cleared to talk about this, I think we were watching a UFO show on some cable channel late at night, you know, when I was visiting my parents, and he was laughing his head off because he said, "Oh, I was at Area 51 that time, and there's nothing like that going on at all." And that's what the older other Roadrunners say as well. So it's pretty well documented. It's all entirely mythology that the secrecy created, and of course the Air Force and CIA were happy to allow to continue.
You've got a very nice chapter in the book where you do detail this, and you talk about Area 51 and what's really going on there.
Right. And we actually led a Skeptic Society field trip a couple of years ago in the wintertime to go as close to Area 51 as the roads allow. You know, you can't go past the security checkpoint. But we did that for the Skeptic Society, and there's a very funny little institution called the Alien, Little Alien, on the north side of the base near Rachel, Nevada, which is just a little tiny watering hole with this restaurant and motel and a handful of trailer houses is all it is. And they have this amazing displays on the inside where all this UFO stuff is on the walls. And movies that film out there, often you go to Little Alien, and some of them are actually used Alien in the movie because it's so legendary a place. And anyway, so yeah, we did an Area 51 trip there a couple of years ago.
I went to Las Vegas 2 years ago, maybe last year, for Christmas with my company. And they gave us like some adventure money to go out and do different things. That was 2 years ago. And we went to my wife and I took off straight from the airport and hopped in a rental car and drove up to Rachel to go check it out.
It's a crazy place, yeah.
It's a long drive, yeah. But it is. There's really nothing there. It's like a trailer park with a gift shop. But I do love all the crap I bought. I've got T-shirts and mugs and posters and all that. So.
Oh, yeah, you got a T-shirt for Blade.
That's right. I was going to say,
I'm wearing one of mine right now, as a matter of fact.
Awesome.
They have, for some reason, all these dollar bills stapled to the ceiling right above the bar. I don't know what the story behind that was. And out front, they have an old satellite dish that's glued to some other satellite dish, and then hanging from the end of a tow truck cable, and that's their flying saucers. So,
you mention Annie Jacobson's Area 51 book and give a really brief summary, but kind of a takedown on it too. So, can you mention that, because that was a very popular book when it came out? But I was a little annoyed by it. So,
Tim and I were both there when she defended her book in front of Skeptic Society back when it still met in Pasadena at Caltech, and so there were 400, 500 people there. The room was packed. And she basically, you know, spent 90% of time, as she does in the book, just giving the more or less mundane details of all this kind of spy craft that were going on at the time. All of it's just stuff she got right out of the files that were released from the Freedom of Information Act once this thing opened. There was a book there. And so most of that was not that really controversial. I mean, she wouldn't probably sold that many copies if she just reported that only. But at the very end of her book, this was the hooker that she got to get the media's attention. She made this ridiculous claim that she talked to one of the roadrunners, one of the people who had worked there, and of course gave no names, and said this person had claimed that in fact there was a spacecraft and an alien body at Area 51, which had come from Roswell, and even to make it stranger, it apparently, according to her story, this person claimed this person was a mutant that was developed by the Nazis during the end of World War II, and it had all these strange features because they had genetically altered it or whatever, which is sort of at the real extreme of crazy. And then it had been covered up because it had flown through the spacecraft that had crashed at Roswell. So she managed to tie Roswell to Area 51 and then add Nazis to the whole story. So that was guaranteed to get the press attention. And if you read all the publicity she got at that time, virtually all the thing that any of the reporters ever talked about was this one ridiculous story that she talked about. And, of course, the minute she finished explaining this, the skeptical audience we were a part of just tore it apart. Because, you know, most everything else she reported now has been corroborated by multiple witnesses. It's not in the actual Air Force reports. It's in various Roadrunner reports. But this one was only one witness, and we were all saying, well, could it have been that he maybe he was senile? Could it have been he was pulling your leg? But she still reported it with a straight face, which I think she was laughing all the way to the bank at the end.
So in your book, you talk about some of the issues with the various types of encounters. So for a little while, we'd like to discuss some of those. But first, what are those encounter types and where do they come from?
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I'd seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Everybody, shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Yeah, the different scales, Hynek scale.
Yeah. Hynek.
And, essentially, the close encounters of the first kind are just that you were within, I guess, 50 meters of a UFO. The second kind is that you've got some kind of physical evidence like the good old Bob White artifact. Third one is that you've actually met with the aliens, and the fourth kind is if you've been abducted by them. And so we have a chapter on each of those kinds of encounters. It's particularly interesting, again, when you look into it, you find stuff that's quite interesting, but not really extraterrestrial, like the Bob White artifact, which turns out to be a stalactite that forms on the inside of large stationary grinders when bits of metal that are molten and been ground off get stuck together, and this thing grows. It looks very organic.
So what is a close encounter of the first kind?
Well, you have to get within, within, I guess it's 50 meters of the ship. Maybe you see an alien or you see a ship, but you haven't got physical evidence, and you haven't talked to them exactly. You've just seen them. That would be the first kind.
Let's see. The second kind is that's the where there's some kind of physical evidence, right?
Physical evidence, yeah. And we go through that in different things. Some of them have very interesting explanations, like the Delphos ring in Kansas, that these people saw something and afterwards found this glowing ring, and the woman and his family touched it and her hand went numb. It all sounds very spooky. It turns out it's armor, really Armillaria. Anyway, it's a fungus. Armillaria fungus, yeah. That is bioluminescent and also produces oxalic acid as a byproduct. And if you touch it, it's an irritant and can either cause you pain or cause your skin to go numb. And so, you know, it's a lot of things where people don't know some obscure bit of science, like not too many people know about bioluminescent fungi. And so when they encounter this, which will grow, fungi grow out in a ring, they come from a central point, and the mycelia grow out and then die off in the center, and the ring keeps expanding. Some people don't know about this, then, and they see something odd, that they may have seen ball lightning above it, it's possible. And, you know, then there's this belief that it's a UFO.
Yeah, and you could also put crop circles in the category of physical evidence that's supposedly left behind by aliens. And the irony on crop circles, of course, is that they have a very simple explanation. Almost every one of them has been acknowledged to be a hoax. You know, all it takes is a clever hoaxer with a board and a rope and a stake, and they can make all sorts of interesting patterns in any kind of crop you like. And it's been done over and over again and confessed by as a hoax over and over again. Yet there are still lots of people who take this seriously, and it's the limits of absurdity that someone would imagine something would travel across these gigantic interstellar distances only just to drop patterns in our crops and then leave without contacting us.
There was another hoax where a guy showed a film of this light buzzing over it and forming a crop circle, and he's saying, "Oh my, look at that!" You know, very breathlessly. And then he did this to show how easy it was a hoax, because he said, "I did this as a hoax, and here's how I did it." And he, you know, did it with in the computer and such. And people, one of the crop circle enthusiasts said, "No, it's obviously real. It's real. This light was creating this crop circle. It's a UFO." And in a way, his attempt to debunk this only heightened the belief of the believers.
Hey, I know one section in the book you go through quite a few of the alleged alien skulls or alien hybrid skulls, and it seemed like every one of them had a very good natural explanation. Don, did your paleontology background come in handy in going through those?
Yeah, most of those were done by Tim. Yeah, no, Tim was debunked a lot of them, mostly, you know, human skulls that have been deformed, you know, by being put in a cradle board and things like that, or various other sources. But the one that we were running into, we'd stumble onto this on the internet, and it was this, this claim that they had an alien skull from this place, I guess, in Romania, which they shows up on the internet over and over again as this supposed alien skull. And hang on, the name escapes me now. Hang on here.
Rodopi. Rodopi.
Yeah, that's right. Rodopi, yeah. It's in Romania. And the minute I saw this on the internet, I said, what the heck? That's not a skull, you know, and not the way they oriented it. And I looked at it closer from the pictures of it, and it's a broken back half of a animal skull, and it's probably either a calf or maybe a goat. And that's all there is to it. And if you know your animal anatomy, you can see, well, they broke the snout off, that's all. So you're looking at the various cavities on the inside of the skull and the sinus regions and the ethmoid regions. That's what they're calling the eye sockets and all these other things. It just shows they don't know any anatomy. And so I got together with a Russian colleague of mine who was much closer to the sources and also a really good paleontologist. And he helped me get a bunch of images of, you know, he took a cow skull out and cut it up. And he shows you can just slice right through it a certain way. You'll get exactly the same as the Rodopi skull. Then the second one that was on this almost the same website is one that's another one that comes from the Caucasus Mountains of Russia. And again, that's claimed to be this alien skull. But if you look at it closer, you know your animal anatomy. It's just the back of the skull of a mountain ibex of some kind, because you can tell what's claimed to be eye sockets. It's actually the bases of the horns. So it's just plain old anatomical incompetence that you see. And then, of course, the power of the internet to blow these images up. And, of course, both of them, well, one of them may still exist, but the Rodopi skull is claimed to be lost. So there's no way ever to find out exactly what it really was.
A lot of them, like the Sealand skull, also is mysteriously lost. And the height or depth of scientific illiteracy is evident when they refer to the something as part of the Rodopi skull as the mouth hole. You know, you don't have a mouth hole. You have a jawbone that's
right.
Separate.
I remember when I was maybe just in college, we found a cow pelvis that was all bleached, and it made a really nice mask. We called it the butt head because you really all kinds of different parts of a skeleton can look face-like. You know, we already have that tendency to find faces, and if you don't have the whole skeleton, it's easy to assume that parts are, you know, used for different things. And then it goes back to the cyclops and the elephant skull, that the nasal cavity being presumed to be a giant single eye hole, that sort of thing. So.
Yeah.
The history of monsters and rotten animals is long and deep.
So,
ironically, we're not talking about a level of civilization here. I've got a great book on that was the Smithsonian Institution book, and it talked about this fossil hunter in one point where. He's digging up the fossil of a three-toed horse, and a Sioux Indian, this is not too long after the Battle of Little Bighorn, and they were newly on the reservation, this Sioux Indian came up and looked at him, scrutinized it, and he kept on working while the guy scrutinized. Suddenly the guy said in the language of the Lakota, little horse. In other words, he had a sophisticated knowledge of comparative anatomy, since they'd seen a lot of skeletons, that he could tell this is the three-toed horse, which is very much smaller than an ordinary, was actually a horse. And, you know, probably if this guy had been around and seen the Rodopi skull, he'd say, oh, back end of a cow skull.
It's only us Westerners that are so illiterate about anatomy, not more primitive peoples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, another fun part of the book is where you cover several prominent contactees. So that's the chapter on the third kind. So would you like to talk a little bit about some of the patterns that you've observed within this group of people?
Go ahead, Tim. That's your...
Hang on. Let's try to think. Which were you thinking about, like George Adamski and some of the others? Like, they... quite often form a little cult around themselves. They, George Adamski, led some people out to the desert, and he talked about somebody, a doctor, Williamson, and turns out the guy was not a doctor, a doctor of any sort. And all these people who were supposedly just ordinary folks were actually already aficionados. And he went over a hill and came running back an hour later saying, "I just talked to a man from Venus." And there's a lot of credulity involved. Interesting thing is that paradoxically, the more absurd the narrative, the more outrageous the activities of a cult leader, and the more often that predictions and prophecies fail, the more it tightens belief among the followers. It tends to drive off the skeptics. I had an encounter with a friend of mine and I when I was in college, kept going by the Scientology thing. We said, "Well, let's go in and see what it's like." And we listened to the thing. L. Ron Hubbard was on this show, British talk show, and he was he's supposed to be a neurosurgeon and a physicist, and he came across as a complete boob. And they had us interviewed by the success secretary to try to just kind of being given a nudge to say that Scientology has helped you already. And I told him exactly what I thought, which was not terribly complimentary, and was sort of blown off very quickly. So, the absurdity of the narrative drives off the skeptics. So, it sets up the belief system very well. And
suckers go for it, yeah.
In your book, you talk about ancient aliens, give some coverage for that. And I thought you hit a lot of really good stuff, too. I think, is it Puma Punku? I don't know how to pronounce that exactly.
Puma Punku, yes.
And the Baghdad Battery and Ezekiel's Wheel. And we also, you talked about Nibiru and Sitchin, and we talked about those topics. But the Ezekiel's Wheel topic I thought was really interesting because I'd heard, I think Jason Colavito had talked about that a little bit, where the it's commonly referenced as evidence of UFOs in the Bible. In fact, there used to be a TV show called Project Blue Book, which I think was retitled Project UFO, which was from the guy who did Dragnet. I can't think of his name right now. But anyway, that was part of the intro, was Ezekiel saw the wheel, and this is the wheel he saw, and it would show a picture of a spaceship. So can you talk about what the real reference to Ezekiel's wheel imagery was about?
The only thing in Ezekiel's vision is that he saw wheels within wheels. And everything else, he saw beasts with four faces, and eagles and lions and a bull and a human. And essentially, and wings and so on, all of which goes to the imagery of the cherubim. The cherub is a kind of an angel that could appear as an ordinary man. It can also appear as this kind of winged lion with a human head that you see in Assyrian monuments. In other words, it had the wings of an eagle, the forepart of a lion, the back part of a bull, and a human head. So this was, in other words, it had the bull is the foremost domestic beast, the lion is the foremost wild beast, the eagle is the foremost bird, and the human head gives reason. This is a type of angel. It's a symbolic representation. And Ezekiel's vision is a vision of Yahweh enthroned upon the cherubim. It's just, and there's just this one little thing that he says, a wheel within a wheel. And that's it. And this has been magnified by so many people. The latest one I can think of is Louis Farrakhan, claiming that it's something was made in Japan in ancient times and so on, and it's the great mother wheel and so on and so forth, and goes into his whole racial superiority thing of the black people versus white people and so on. There's just nothing there. It would really help if people who are making notes off of something in the Bible would actually read the Bible itself. And
so speaking of the Bible, you've got a very interesting chapter, chapter 9, which is called Praying to Aliens, and you discuss some of the UFO religious groups and their beliefs. And a number of years ago, I did an investigation for CSI, and it was into a group called Share International, headed by a fellow called Benjamin Krem, and all of his theories about space brothers and space sisters and Maitreya. So can you tell us a little bit about this group and other religious UFO groups?
Well, they're still around. A friend of ours who is into MUFON visit us and went to the their convention, and Maitreya's being Benjamin Krem is still there doing his thing, and Maitreya has actually an aspect of Buddha. It's one of his incarnations that's to come in the future. The Theosophists, thought they had that, and that Maitreya was this young man they found in India, and it's turned who became Krishnamurti. And he later on said, "No, this isn't real. It's a, you know, you've been very kind to me and such, but I'm not your Maitreya." And of course, then got folded into the UFO thing, since Maitreya would obviously come back down from the heavens and with our space brothers and whatnot. So there's a great deal of religious belief involved in it. There's even some Christian UFO religions. The Seekers in the 50s were one, and we've got now the Ordo Fiat Lux. Fiat Lux is Latin for "Let there be light." It's there somewhere in the Black Forest right now.
I think it's fascinating because I knew some of the things that you covered, but some of them were new to me. I didn't realize how much of the Vril idea is still tied into modern UFO religious movements. And that comes from Edward Bulwer Lytton, whom most of our readers will know from one of two places, probably the It Was a Dark and Stormy Night was the intro to one of his novels. And the other one is there's a bad writing contest that they have every year about who can write the worst opening sentence for a book. He was, I don't think he was a bad writer, but his idea, which was the coming race, I think. It ties into Theosophy, and it has ties, weirdly, to the Morning of the Magicians, which in turn is probably the inspiration for Von Daniken. So you get this fictional book that pushes Theosophy that's tied to all these ancient astronaut religious movements. It's fascinating to me how it all comes together.
Where I kind of got interested in the Vril thing was I saw this thing on the supposed sort of Nazism from the Vril Society. They had this documentary on the so-called History Channel. And the whole thing is completely fabricated. The Maria Orsic, who's supposed to be this beautiful woman that had contacted aliens and understood the Vril energy and so on, was apparently made up in Morning of the Magicians, and they got some portrait of some woman and you can see her on the internet, but I don't know if she ever existed. Probably didn't. The only thing close to a Vril society is Willie Lay, when he is a science popularizer and rocket scientist. He fled the Nazi Germany before World War II, and he wrote a little essay and an article in Astounding Science Fiction in 1949, I believe it was, titled "Pseudoscience in Nazi Land," and just mentioned in passing a society called the Warheits Gesellschaft, if I'm not massacring that too badly, which meant the Society for Truth, who were looking for Vril. And he said, yes, that's right. They were based on this book by Bulwer Lytton. And that's all he says. And out of this, again, this grand edifice has been made out of nothing.
Well, I think we have a really good opportunity here for a TV show for the History Channel. You ready?
Okay.
Vril Housewives of Atlantis. Huh? I think
You got to find a way to sell it somehow, right? Yeah. So what we talked about at the beginning of our interview is pretty much the story here, that in lots of ways, UFO belief and UFO cult followings have lots of the trappings of religion, and they feel a need, which we see also with cryptozoology, that people like to have something mysterious in their life. And you find this sort of, you know, is this the first time in all of human existence, this last century or so, where most of the great mysteries have now been explained by science, and a lot of the mysterious religion is no longer believed by a high percentage of people in the world. And so you find people still have that need for mystery. They still have that need for unexplained phenomena, you know, to give them a sense of meaning or give them something that they feel isn't quite understood. And I think that drives a lot of both cryptozoology and also UFO belief. It's all this, the paranormal is appealing. It gives people meaning in some cases. It gives them something to speculate about. And we've not, especially with cryptozoology taking care of all the supposed monsters, you know, we don't have a world without monsters now. Somebody has to create them, and likewise, a world without angels, we get UFOs and aliens instead. So I think that's a large part of it. And then there's also this, the bigger issue that people believe anecdotal evidence, they believe eyewitness evidence first and foremost, and that's where this comes from, is the seeing things that they claim they saw, and therefore they believe. And the people listening to them are convinced, but of course the thing we had to establish really early in the book was that that does not constitute evidence of scientific nature.
Tim, is there anything you want to add to that?
I think a lot of that shows up in pareidolia. People read patterns into, cloud formations, and lenticular clouds that people see quite often as flying saucers or something like that. And, we do have a need to create patterns. We are pattern-seeking and pattern-creating species, so that's bound to happen. And if you don't have a governor on it, you can believe almost anything.
Which is what science is trying to save us from.
Yeah, that seems to be a recurring theme lately towards the end of this year, is the idea that we keep running into the idea that all theories are equal. And I think what science does is says, no, that's not true. There is a way to filter out between what's plausible or possible and what's not possible.
Well, that's our job. So
we've got a final question for you both, in particular Tim, because this is your first time on the show. And we normally like to ask what's your favorite monster, but given the theme of this episode, we thought we'd like to ask you instead, what's your favorite UFO story?
Yeah, as far as absurdity goes, I suppose the whole edifice of the reptilians of David Icke would be the favorite one as far as complete fantasy. I don't know if I have a favorite story beyond that.
That's a pretty good one, though.
It is, yeah.
Our last guest was self-identifying as a reptilian.
What? Yeah, ties in nicely.
It's a long story,
but they're real.
You can listen to our previous episode to understand that. It's a good story. So,
what about you, Don?
Oh, I guess because my father's connected to it, I would say the Area 51 story. I mean, I have a family connection to it. My dad was actually there at the right time, so I guess you would say that's my favorite.
That's awesome.
Nice.
Well, I wish we could talk longer, but I think you've got a great book here, and it's a hard thing to dive into something where so many people have so many intense beliefs about such minutia, but you guys did a good job, I believe, and I think our listeners will really enjoy this.
Yeah,
well, thank you
lots
very
of
much.
Interesting facets.
Yep.
Yeah. It's hard to decide what to include, what to leave out. It could have been twice as long easily. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've left one or two encounters out. I thought, gee, maybe I should have put that one in. But, I could make a whole book out of just alien abductions. So.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. So it's
equal.
Well, I mean,
next project.
As many people have, right? I mean, I've got a few on my shelves, right? So.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We know a few people personally.
That's right.
But not too many skeptical approaches. That was one thing I thought our book was different from most of the rest, is that, yeah, there are a few individual books by people like Schaefer and others that attack one or two stories specifically. Mm-hmm. But what we really tried to do with this book is to be very broad in the sense that we cover almost the entire field, and something I did also with the cryptozoology book, which is introduce the rules of evidence and introduce the rules of science at the beginning to really establish ground rules, which almost nobody really tries to do. And then we didn't have time to talk about it, but the last chapter talks about the psychology of people who believe in UFOs, which is, again, something you don't see a lot of other UFO group books talk about. So I think we tried to do a lot of different kinds of things that make it interesting for people to read.
I think you've done a good job. So I maybe some people will be getting this under their Christmas trees or whatever they do for the holidays. So.
Thank you for joining us, guys.
All right. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Monster Talk is the science show about monsters. And this week you heard us interview Don Prothrow and Timothy Callahan about their new book, UFOs, Chemtrails, and Aliens. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
Saw the wheel. This is the wheel he said he saw. These are unidentified flying objects that people say they are seeing now.